BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Just a word of warning. This podcast includes strong language, use of racist terms, and descriptions of violence. Be warned. April 1981, Brixton is a war zone.
There was an acridness of all the smoke. You heard sirens absolutely constantly. You saw small groups of people, you know, running up and down in bandanas. You saw burnt out cars skewed across the road. Lots of detritus on the roads from the petrol bombs being thrown in. What is going on here? The anger of Brixton has turned to flame.
In this episode, we go back to our Brixton boys, Sheldon, Christopher and Tony, and enter their teenage world where music is everything.
We just wanted to play records because we knew that playing records just brought so much joy to people's lives.
But the feds are never too far away and can pull the plug on the music anytime they want.
We stormed in to this blues party. The PC that I was with made a beeline for the DJ where the speakers were, and punched straight through the two massive speakers.
And that starts a shocking chain reaction.
It got worse. The resentment between us and the police went to an unparalleled level.
This pushes Sheldon down a path of no return into a pitched battle on the front line.
For me, that was the best day of my life. Those days, fighting police officers, because I gave as good as I got. No one wanted us. You know, no one wanted us. Society hated us.
Unlikely allies joined the fight.
It wasn't our fight to go and fight, but it was our fight to not ignore and actually turn round and say, yeah, we're with you.
From BBC Sounds and BBC Radio 5 Live, this is Brixton, Flames on the Frontline. Yo, it's Big Nasty, and this is episode 4, Sides Are Taken.
I don't remember anything outside of our environment. I don't remember any football. I don't remember any politics. I don't remember what was on television, because we didn't do it. We didn't watch television. We didn't listen to the radio. We didn't read the newspaper. Our world was sound system for that good decade. It was a complete world within a world, and the outer world had no relevance.
Christopher, a Brixton boy and best mate of Sheldon, remember the boys from episodes 1 and 2. Now Sheldon's 14 and Christopher's 15, boys who live for music.
That's all it was. Setting up dances, playing dances, buying records, searching for equipment, building equipment, testing equipment, making speaker boxes, playing with other sound systems. That's all it was.
Music is everything to these boys.
So when we talk about going to Brixton, it was a place of sound systems. It was a place of, we believed we were in Jamaica.
It was all consuming. Know what that's like? Well, in this podcast, to help you along and help you feel what our characters felt, we've used their words to recreate pieces of drama to put you right in their shoes. Back in the late 70s, Christopher's living for the weekend. He loves it. It's all good vibes. And even though the feds are buzzing around, life's not bad.
Sound systems were a way of life in Brixton. Everybody was part of a sound system, you know, big speaker boxes, records, heavy amplifiers, played music really loud, shaking the earth with bass and feeling the energy of the dirt. Yeah, the poor man's story, the poor man's struggle, connecting with it and understanding it from our struggle because we were poor. The people in Jamaica were poor and singing these songs. The song spoke directly to us and connected us onto this larger struggle that we knew nothing about. Sound system to us was like how the white society and our peers had football. Like, you'll be a football fan and you'll support your football team and go and cheer for your football team. And you watch them every week. And you'd want them to win. The sound system was a musical version of that. A team, a group of guys, would get together and spend all day making their money, buying equipment and records. And they would play these records at a club under the name of their sound system. And you'd have followers that would follow that sound system and support that sound system. And you'd have clashes with other sound systems where your sound system would play this next sound system from another area, and they would come with their supporters and their fans, and they'll be battled between the two. Musical battles. And one sound system would overcome another sound system. And then they'll get promoted in that way because they were able to beat these other sound systems or outplay these other sound systems and play music that they couldn't get or they didn't know and take away their crowd. So that was our football, if you like. There were Small Acts, there were Stereographic, and there was Dread Diamonds. And we had our own sound system, which we called Ishamala. And in spite of rivalries, what we all shared was what the music was about, because the music was about us. It was about equal rights, freedom, justice, you know. Being black and being seen as a person, being treated as a person. Having or understanding that there are different ways of life, and all of these ways of life are just as valid. So in that sense, the sound system scene was political, and I have no shame in saying that. There were so many blues parties going on, mostly because clubs at the time didn't want to play reggae music. They didn't want the black crowds coming in and causing trouble. So what people started to do was kind of like a club in the house. That's a blues party. You have a sound system with the speakers put up in the living room, you pay at the door to come in. So yeah, it's basically a club, but in somebody's house. We used to hold our blues dances on weekends, every Saturday and Sunday. It was basically a release from the society that we were part of, but didn't feel a part of, if that makes sense. So we built up kind of like a tension, just being there, a negative tension that needed a release. You know, we needed something to touch of our own so that we could be grounded. And the blues party at the end of the week was that space where we could reconnect with our own and be amongst our own, touch with those, you know, the records, the Jamaican reggae records. You know, we'll get a feel of that environment where our parents came from. So it was an important grounding period. You know, not only that, just to hear the news of what was happening. There was always a risk that you could get raided at any time because people were not only selling weed there, alcohol as well. And I remember one particular blues that we played in that the police rock up, came and they took our whole set, our entire equipment. I think they took our stuff because sometimes when they stopped dances in the past, dances just got diverted to a new location. You know, you put the word out on the street and people would know not to go to the first location, but to go to the second location instead. So I think the police started to wise up to that and started confiscating people's equipment in order to slow us down. Us getting the equipment back wasn't any problem, you know. Just turn up at the police station with all your receipts and they would release them. You could take them home. It was a game, man. That's what it felt like. A game in a sense of them wanting to disrupt and make it hard for us. It's a cat and mouse game that just went on and on and on until one side gave up or decided to give up. Well, we weren't going to stop. Not ever. It was our music. It was our time.
Outside the safety of the sound systems, danger is lurking. But for now, all's good. Their love for music is deep. Especially reggae inspired by Rastaman, Gregory Isaacs, Dennis Brown, Bob Marley. Pumped out at max volume from a giant speaker, lashed together, close your eyes and listen. This is how Brixton used to sound. This is home.
There were definite tracks. There's Michael Prophet's Gunman.
From Gunman, standing over me with their guns and their bayonets.
There is Pablo Gad, Hard Times.
I was a very big fan of Al Campbell.
What will you do? 'Cause now is a moment of truth, and all that was hidden will be revealed.
Sugar Minott.
Every little thing you're on, Bobby.
so much music back then, and one of my favourite DJs, or actually the very first DJ that actually ever DJed in the whole wide world, was a DJ called U-Roy, formerly known as Daddy U-Roy.
Why not just get together and live in one love and one identity, you know?
Tony's our other Brixton boy.
We just wanted to play records because we knew that playing records was just brought so much joy to people's lives, you know, and it was definitely part of our culture, you know. Music was always around, you know, you go into any black household, you're going to hear music. So we definitely wanted to be part of that.
These Brixton boys love hanging out. They're still young though, too young for the pubs, but they know the pubs aren't their thing anyway.
We never ever went to a pub, not one time. Pubs were not our scene. There was definitely separation, like in our environment, in the sound system culture, you'd be lucky to see any white people there.
So instead, they make their own space, all of them. Christopher, Sheldon and Tony set up their own sound systems and they take them to blues parties, those makeshift clubs in people's homes or in squats.
Blues dance is where the sound system would go into a house and play music from 10 at night straight through till 10 in the morning the next day. And that's what they call a blues dance. You had a lot of rubber dub, a lot of MC music. And the white men
thought it was a token. Underground clubs and drinking spots aren't just for black guys like Sheldon and his boys. Brixton is also home to another set of people who sometimes feel like outcasts.
You had the gay community, equally vibrant, living there, certainly along the front line and beyond.
The front line, aka Relton Road, rundown, derelict, is where around 40 gay men known as Brixton Fairies set up a squat. They've got a gay centre there too, where there's discos, theatre nights, dance classes, you name it. For Terry and Julian, two guys in their 20s, the front line is somewhere they can live their best lives.
Brixton was a much greater sense of freedom as a young gay man.
Brixton itself has always been an alternative for a whole load of people, and that was no different for gay men who were coming to the city from all over the UK and beyond to find a new life for themselves. And Brixton, in that sense, was a melting pot for them, with quite a vibrant gay scene, with a few pubs and clubs.
But even in Brixton, some pubs still seem exclusively white, male and straight.
You'd be ordered out, no explanation. We don't serve your type in here, get out. We just knew we weren't welcome in local pubs. I mean, if they called the police would have thrown us out or had us arrested. The only pub that I didn't get abused in, believe it or not, were the black pubs. I mean, pubs that openly served black people. Nobody gave the toss. They were called black pubs because they were probably the only pubs that served black people. Now, black people were effectively excluded from other pubs.
And there's one place was a super-duper no-go. In the early 60s, the George on Relton Road had been notorious for refusing to serve black people. In 1965, the Race Relations Act made that illegal. But more than 10 years on, some staff still waited to choose who they serve. Even now, Terry remembers one woman behind the bar who put her views out there.
She said, "I've got to serve the black people, but I'm not serving you fucking queers." Because obviously the law was different. And she was horrible.
That is horrendous behaviour, blood. And a man can't even get a drink in England because you're black or gay. In this podcast, there are some proper upset people. I mean, can you sense why? Like, what would you do? Find somewhere else to go? Forget the pubs. So for a night out, Terry and Julian and the other Brixton Fairies, they go underground and enter the secret world of Shabeens.
If you've never been to a Shabeen, then think of somebody's living room that's been cleared of most furniture. So you've got a space, a hard floor that you can dance on.
A Shabeen is an illegal drinking den, and there is one spot that's the place to be. It's called Pell's Shubbins. It's tucked out of sight. I swear you wouldn't even look twice. It's under a shop, a gay bar, just a few doors down from the George.
Pearl Alcock, she had a shubbin there, and I was downstairs, and you wouldn't get any more than, if there was 10 or 15 people in there, it was crowded, and it was nothing flash about the place. It was right downstairs at the back of the building. You rang the doorbell and you walked all the way down the corridor to a door which took you downstairs. And you went down the stairs and you went beyond this curtain which was across the wall, and you were in Pearl's.
Pearl is a black bisexual woman from Jamaica. You find her behind a makeshift bar every night. For a lot of gay guys, especially black gay guys, it is the only place to go.
It was a black gay shebeen. And what you have to remember is that an awful lot of black people who lived in Brixton would not go and socialise on the normal gay bits of the gay scene in Brixton, because of course there would be that whole thing of being outed in their community. But Pearls was slightly different. It was black run, it was illegal, it was underground. You could buy your Red Strike, you could listen to your reggae, you could dance with your man, or whatever colour they were. Pearl was the matriarch who decided whether whether you were respectful enough and not just a tourist to actually come in and be part of that thing.
And Pearl has the power.
Well, she had more balls than most men that I know. If she had, like in her shebeen, if somebody started trouble, the machete would just come from a table and she'd say, right, if you want to fuck about, you can fuck about with this guy. So I never ever seen her use it. I don't think she would use it. But, you know, a single black woman on your own, you've got to be able to defend yourself.
Pearl's place is unique. It's one of the few places where black and white gay people can mix.
It's a black gay community. And the black gay community socialised away from the white gay community. I mean, there were spaces where the communities mix, and Pearl's is one of them, but once you stepped outside of that, there was kind of demarcation lines between both communities.
Down in Pearl's, like up in the street, the music is where it's at.
Something which was slow, a reggae beat, something that you could dance in a close embrace with somebody. It's a place to smooch and on the side, get to know people, and everybody in the main being able to at least say hello to everybody and chat and sit on a sofa and sit on somebody's lap and have a kiss and a canoodle, and it being very dark little corners, always smoky, low ceiling. Always lots of nice sounds, and always lots of people who you wouldn't see elsewhere on the gay scene, in effect. So it was a place to be.
Whether it's Pearl Shubbins or a blues party, you get the same kind of vibes. You're in a safe space to enjoy yourself, free of aggro.
It was fantastic. It was, again, a place where we found refuge. It's like going to them dances, going to them blues dance, was like we was back in Jamaica, you know? Ganja was there, Tenants. We had a drink called Tenants and Special Brew. So it was very much a Jamaican field environment where the smelling of jerk chicken and the smell of snapper and fry fish and the smell of ackee and saltfish or the smell of dumpling was just fantastic. This was our escape from racism into nice time. But what happened was the police began to raid those dances and smash up man's sound system.
The feds are hard to dodge, and the gay guys, they're feeling mad uncomfortable. They're starting to see it for themselves. And you know what? That sense of persecution we've been hearing about is spreading. You don't have to be black to feel pretty resentful.
I can remember sitting in the window at 159 Railton Road about 4 o'clock in the morning, and the police had just cordoned off the road, and there was literally hundreds of them, and they were going down and they were busting into the blues parties, dragging people out, arresting them, and just destroying the evening's fun for whole groups of people. They were doing it for years.
There's drugs, illegal drink and music pumping. So of course the feds are going to show up. But does that mean they're there to calm it down or ramp it up? Let's check in with one of them.
I was an 18-year-old rookie police officer.
PC Peter Blexley, not much older than the Brixton boys, but from a completely different world.
Posted to Peckham Police Station in 1978, and I'd come from a fairly leafy outer London suburb in Bexley Heath. Suddenly, I was policing Peckham, an inner city area riddled with chronic social deprivation, rampant racism, and a lot of crime. When I first got to Peckham, they wouldn't allow me out on the streets because I hadn't reached my 19th birthday. I pestered everybody to let me go out and became a real pain because while sitting in the control room meant I learnt a lot, I wanted to be out on the streets. Eventually, the inspector caved in, I think basically just to shut me up, and he sent me out on the search of what was then known as a blues club. Essentially, an illegal gathering in a basement flat where people would pay to go in and pay for alcohol. It was all unlicensed, so it was kind of regarded as being subversive and almost crime of the century, and it had to be shut down.
On his first job out, he sees how sound systems are a target.
We stormed in to this blues party. The PC that I was with made a beeline for the DJ, where the speakers were and the records. No sooner had we got there than from his truncheon pocket, which is on the inside of your police trousers, he pulled out a very long and slender knitting needle, which he then punched straight through the two massive speakers. We then went round to the record collection, which he systematically went through, stamping his heel onto every record, thereby ruining them. People at the blues party, as soon as they could hear us coming, dropped drugs on the floor, cannabis. I saw police officers picking that cannabis up and then attributing it to the person that they didn't quite like the look of, and so they would get arrested. Tension was high, tempers got frayed.
Yeah, man, the party stopped. The fun was over.
People were getting unceremoniously dragged out of this party, thrown into the back of a police van, and carted off to Peckham Police Station. And I thought, oh, right. I had nothing to benchmark it against, apart from, of course, my own conscience. But I'm a naive 18-year-old kid, in essence. And I thought, right, this is how it's done.
All right, hold up. You know by now what these parties mean to the Brixton boys. But they had raids like this, and they're the final straw for Sheldon.
They kept attacking us. They kept attacking us every day. If it wasn't in the dance, it was when you was walking on the streets.
He's already on edge. Years of police harassment, stop and search, racist abuse, it's all building up. And there's another thing, this one memory that's pushing Sheldon to the edge. About this time, the far right are circling. We already heard about firebombings. Well, can you imagine just going about your business and thinking someone might just jump on you for no reason, for the colour of your skin? And this could happen anywhere, when you least expect it.
My brother, who had come over from Jamaica three, four years previous, and my other brother went to a fun fair in Clapham.
I don't even need to say nothing about this being no fun.
My older brother was battered by 15 skinheads, stamped in the face, stamped on the chest, stamped consistently, and all of this under police officers who were laughing. That was when I changed. I believe I was not normal after that. My brother crawled home. His face was contorted. His face was full of blood, covered from head to toe. I was so traumatized by the whole thing. All I wanted to do was, now we're going to go out and hurt some people.
I understand Sheldon's pain still. He's hurting, but his folks are from a different generation and they're not like him.
They went and called the police, which did not make any sense to me. Calling the police The very police that was laughing when my brother was nearly being killed by 15 skinheads who had steel toe cap boots. You are so up Britain that you would phone the same people that nearly took your son's life to come and help your son identify the people that nearly killed him. That makes no sense to me.
He feels like the feds are everywhere. They're lingering, scratching him, bugging his nut. So when they even penetrate the sound system world, his sanctuary, it hits a nerve. They targeted his music. He's done.
And so for us now, the resentment grew. The interaction with the police went to a level of hate. And so from then we realised that this is now getting out of hand. This is now getting to the point where we're going to have to do something.
Sheldon meets violence with violence.
We formed what today you call them street gangs, but back then we called posses. So we formed a posse to protect ourselves from racist police officers. Because every time we were on our own, the police officers would beat us up. I realized, you know, everything about them was about aggression. So I responded aggressively.
Sheldon sets up a gang and he's the main man, armed with a baseball bat and a belly full of hate.
So the following year, it got worse. The resentment between us and the police went to an unparalleled level.
He's not running from the police no more. He's way past that.
We would sit down sometimes and figure out our plan to kidnap a police and torture his ass. Sorry, I've just used a language that is very much Jamaican. So that's the language we used back then. You know, we would sit there and try to figure out how could we do this, because we were hell-bent now on hurting police. Because they were now not only racially abusing us, they were smashing up our sound systems.
Now, let me keep it real. He never does actually catch a cop, even though he might want to. You know what? You could say Sheldon's reaction is extreme. He's had a hard time. He's vexed. It's pretty clear to the whole world how he feels because he's lashing out. Turn into violence. And so you can see that. But the thing is, there are other Sheldons, and not all of them let it out. So it's building up, it's simmering. And is he a particular target? Are the feds just after him? Let's ask a cop.
There were some deeply shameful practices carried out on people whilst they were held in police stations. On one particular occasion, there was an enormous dust-up with a Rastafarian and a handful of his dreadlocks were pulled out. Well, they were later pinned to the wall of the crime squad office as some kind of sick and yet proud trophy. On another occasion, a young man was arrested and was being questioned for burglary. He was forced to kneel on the floor and his toes were put on the skirting board, so his toes were raised behind him. His heels were then trodden on, which, as the pressure increased, so the excruciating pain increased. And that was a tactic designed to get him to confess.
It wasn't just me waking up one day and saying, you know what, I'm going to burn Brixton down. I'm going to beat up police officers. No, I want to make sure people know that Brixton gangs are bad. That was because anger consumed me so much.
Because of the feds, because of the National Front, because of everything that's happened to him, everything has changed. Even the most important thing, his relationship with music, even that becomes about fighting back.
So in 1980, our sound system began to make a name for itself, mainly because we were violent, because of our links to our posse. So we had a posse link to us, which was me. I was also the sound man as well. I was the person who owned the sound. So I had two roles, one as a sound man and one as the leader of the posse. And it was my job to make sure anytime we played anywhere, we had our weapons and make sure we're all tooled up. So By the time 1980 had arrived, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, I believe the National Front began to get scared of black people because we began to organize. So it wasn't as easy for them now to attack us because we had a crew.
There's no going back. Sheldon's on a hair trigger now. He is on to the feds. So it's not a total surprise when it all kicks off.
I think that when the riots started off, for most Brixton residents, they thought, well, that was bound to happen, wasn't it?
Different communities who were very, very separate but had a certain amount of respect for each other realised that, you know, we all suffered our oppressions differently. So I think there was a feeling of, you know, this is an attack upon the communities of people who are suffering at the hands of an unregulated, discriminatory state. So in some ways, we're all in it together.
So when 81 came along and the kids went out and burned and wrecked, whilst I don't agree with it, you could see it coming and it was going to happen. You can't just move a police force in en masse and try and destroy a community, their right to socialise, simply because they were black.
If you push people too far, you know, this isn't a question of, you know, breaking the straw on the camel's back. The camel will actually turn around and bite you.
So that's how I became this thug, this nasty, hateful, mentally disturbed guy that would wake up every day saying, what white man am I going to kill today? What police officer am I going to maim today?
That's episode 4. Next time, a party in South London ends in tragedy. Kids are trapped upstairs in a burning building.
I said, Yvonne, jump, jump, Yvonne, fire, jump, Yvonne, mommy will catch you.
I stood there and saw every one of the children lay out on the pavement, every one of them. And I looked at every one of them and they were screaming. And when the screams had stopped, I said to myself, they're all dead.
And that tragedy exposes the glaring inequalities in British society, and people take sides. Either you're with us or against us.
This is Nas. I'm here to tell you about a new podcast about the greatest there ever was.
Muhammad Ali versus Joe Frazier was more than a prize fight.
A fight that stopped the world in its tracks.
It's an onslaught now, and he's down.
A fight that changed the world forever.
15 hours ago, I left the ringside of Madison Square Garden, New York, carrying with me the videotape recording of one of the most extraordinary fights of all time.
A boxing match that transcended the sport.
Muhammad Ali became a martyr in many ways. He forsaked everything to refuse to go and fight.
The fight of the century, Ali versus Frazier. Listen on the BBC Sounds app.